today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
Friends, I want you to think about it in light of eternity, which is not the light under which Solomon is considering things. But in the light of eternity, we would say this, that for the godly, for those who are the purchased people of God in Jesus Christ, for the godly, this world is the worst you will ever have it. For the ungodly, for those who reject God and His way of salvation, think about it. This world, even with all of its impression and terrors, this world is the best they will ever have it.
Let's face it, sometimes this world really stinks. We see the oppression of people around the world, others being killed simply because of what they believe or the color of their skin. It's saddening. As Pastor David will be sharing, Solomon observed much of the same things in his time, and it brought him despair too. Fortunately, Jesus came to redeem us and to give us another option in life. We need to tell as many people as we can that there's hope for their lives in Jesus. Now, here's Pastor David with part one of his message, Unsatisfying Wealth.
Let's open up our Bibles to the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 4. I don't want to frighten anybody, but tonight we're going to go through three chapters of Ecclesiastes. And if you think, oh, heavens, that's too much to go through, I think you should know that there are some advantages to going through some passages of Scripture at a more rapid pace. In Ecclesiastes, it's really a book that deals with big ideas that are sort of examined from a lot of different angles. And so I think we don't want to lose ourselves in the minutiae of the details, even though there would be some profit in doing a greatly in-depth study of Ecclesiastes. There's also profit in sort of making your way and getting more of a bird's eye view. In addition, honestly, if we spent too many weeks in Ecclesiastes, we'd all be really depressed, right? So it's better to make our way through a little bit more quickly. So tonight we're going to do chapters 4, 5, and 6. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, beginning now at verse 1. Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there is power, but they have no comforter. Again, in the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon, who characterizes himself as the preacher in this book, he's examining life from a particular premise. Sort of the code word for that premise throughout the book of Ecclesiastes is this phrase found in the very first line of verse 1, chapter 4, under the sun. And under the sun basically has the idea of in this world as we know it without taking into account eternity. It doesn't mean without God, but it means without eternity and without the need to answer to God in the world beyond. It means just under this sun, under this atmosphere, as we know it right here, right now. And so now he's concerning himself with the meaninglessness of life if it's to be considered apart from eternity. And this is part of his great contention right here. He looks at it in verse 1, and he says, look at all this. Look at the tears of the oppressed. At the end of chapter 3, he flirted with hope. But now he's once again turned to the despair at the end of Ecclesiastes chapter 3, where he considered the problem of injustice. And so now continuing along the same lines, he considers all the oppression that's done under the sun. And in a very poetically powerful phrase, he talks about the tears of the oppressed who have no comforter. Friends, when you think about it, there's an awful lot of oppression in this world, isn't there? And the Bible's concerned with it, is it not? You go through the pages of the Old Testament, you find in the law of Moses and you find in the pronouncements of the prophets in the Old Testament, they're concerned with all kinds of oppression. They're concerned with the way that the rich can oppress the poor, with the powerful can oppress the weak, with the ungodly can oppress the godly, with the way that the wicked can oppress the just. They're struck with the way that sometimes people in power and in positions of justice can deal out injustice instead of what they're supposed to do. And so as he considered the tears of the oppressed and that they have no comforter, Solomon thought of this painful and tear-filled world that the lives of oppressed people live. And in an under-the-sun world, a world where this life is all there is and men and women give no account for their lives in the world to come, then the tears of the oppressed are especially bitter, and there is no one to give them comfort. If you think about it, if this life is all there is, if God does not have a way of setting things correct in justice and judgment in a world to come, then there's a lot of people who get away. I'll say it. I mean it both as a phrase, but I also mean it literally. They get away with murder, do they not? Are there not a lot of people who get away with horrible oppression against other people because they never have to answer for it in this life? They laugh at their victims. They enjoy the pain, or at least they seem to. They inflict upon other people, or at best, they're blind to it. And if this life is all there is, if there is no eternity, if all of life can be defined under that premise of under the sun, then no wonder Solomon is concerned about this. There's nobody to comfort the person who has the tears of the oppressed. And he's so stricken by this. Look at this in verse 2. He says, "Therefore I praise the dead who were already dead, more than the living who were still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun." Do you see what he's saying there? He's saying because of oppression and the sadness that it brings into the world, man is better off dead. The thought of the oppressors and their victims was so painful to the writer of Ecclesiastes that the fact that they found no justice in this world and that they would find no justice in eternity because it doesn't fit under his premise, it was so bitter to the preacher that he thought of the dead as being fortunate. You see, in an under-the-sun world, the dead don't have to think of things like that, right? In an under-the-sun world, death is nothing but a release. Now, friends, I have to warn you here that Solomon's basic premise of an under-the-sun world is not true. It is not accurate. This life is not all there is. And there are some people who, in a tragic fit of the tears of oppression or the despair of the moment or an extended season of despair and comfortlessness in their life, they feel driven perhaps to take their own life. And they think that they're going to pass to something better or pass to nothing. Friends, that's under the sun thinking, but it's not real thinking. You see, Solomon could only praise the dead this way because at his time, he had no certain knowledge of the world to come. And he wrote most of Ecclesiastes with this under the sun premise. But if he knew and accepted what happened to the righteous dead, he would never say such a thing. He would never say that people are better off dead. Friends, I want you to think about it in light of eternity, which is not the light under which Solomon is considering things. But in the light of eternity, we would say this, that for the godly, for those who are the purchased people of God in Jesus Christ, for the godly, this world is the worst you will ever have it. For the ungodly, for those who reject God and his way of salvation, think about it. This world, even with all of its impression and terrors, this world is the best they will ever have it. And Solomon wasn't allowing himself to think this way. Oh, I think he believed it in his heart of hearts. But in the writing of Ecclesiastes, he says, no, I'm going to put all of that on the shelf and I'm going to consider life in an under the sun kind of premise. One of the commentators I like to read from time to time is this old Puritan fellow, John Trapp. And he gave a very interesting illustration of this idea. He said this, I'll read it and then I'll explain it. He said, "Men, like silly fishes, see one another caught and jerked out of the pond of life, but they cannot see, alas, the fire and the pan into which they are cast and they die in their sins." You just think of a little fish swimming around, right? And all of a sudden your little friend fish gets jerked out of the water, right? What happens to him? You don't know. You just don't know. You just know he's gone. What you don't know is that he's now roasting in a pan, right? Now, you may feel comforted that you don't know that. But friends, just because it didn't happen before your eyes doesn't mean that it didn't happen. So it's a very vivid illustration that John Trapp gives, and it's the kind of thinking that Solomon will not allow himself to think about under this premise. One other thing before we leave it. In verse 2, he used a very interesting phrase, "I praise the dead who were already dead." I like that. It's an interesting phrase because it implies that there are the dead who are not yet dead. There are the living dead, are there not? And they walk this earth and they have biological life, but their spirit and their soul seem dead. I wonder if I'm not speaking to somebody like that right here tonight. You're the living dead. Oh, you walk and you can fog up a mirror, but there's no spiritual life in you. I tell you, you don't have to leave this room tonight like that. Jesus Christ can give you life. And if you come to him, he will not reject you. You don't have to be one of those who are dead but yet alive. Going on now, verse 3, he says, better than both is he who never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. Solomon took the idea of praising the dead even further. You see, to where he now praised he who has never existed, the dead who were once alive and had to see the evil work that was done under the sun. You see, the preacher's great despair over the injustice and the oppression in an under-the-sun premise shows the moral necessity of an afterlife and a coming judgment. Jesus told us this, that those who oppress and misuse their power will ultimately endure punishment, not their victims. Do you remember what Jesus said? He said it in a very powerful way in Matthew chapter 18. He said, woe to those who offend one of these little ones. It would be better for them if a millstone was put around their neck and they were cast into the sea. Now think about that. Think about having a great big millstone tied around your neck, a huge boulder, so to speak. And then it's tied to your neck and you're thrown out into the middle of the channel. That would be a tough way to go, would it not be? Jesus said it would be better for that person than it would be for those who offend one of his little ones, who misuse them, who oppress them. And friends, notice that. It's not the oppressors who will enjoy and laugh it up in that day. No, it's the oppressed who will be comforted, and those oppressors, they will be judged in the world to come. Going on now, verse 4. Again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Better a handful with quietness than both hands full, together with toil and grasping for the wind. I like this is very interesting in verse 4. For all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. The preacher thought of those who gain success through toil and skillful work. Well, there you are. You're a hardworking man. You're a hardworking woman. And through your toil, through your ingenuity, through your skillful work, you work really hard. And what does it gain you? The preacher tells you in verse 4, it gains you the envy of your neighbors. They hate you now because you're a big success. Congratulations. You are successful enough to where everybody hates you. You could just imagine the guy that Solomon's thinking about, right? He works so hard. He works smart. He puts it all in. And then what does he get at the end of it all? Great. Thank you very much. Now everybody hates me. They're all jealous of me. And you just think, no wonder he says it's vanity and grasping for the wind. I thought that I'd find meaning for my life through my hard work, through my skillful work. And it gained me a lot. I can't deny it. But you know, it's meaningless because now just everybody hates me. And then he says the reaction here, verse 5, there's the fool. What does the fool do? He's lazy. He folds his hand and he consumes his own flesh. And here he answered the tendency for those who are jealous of the success of others to be lazy. And like fools, they fold their hands and they do nothing. And so they waste away. It wasn't the success of their neighbors that made them waste away. No, the foolish, lazy man, he consumes his own flesh. But then he comes to a conclusion right here in verse 6, that it's better a handful with quietness, a handful with contentment, than both hands full together with toil and grasping for wind. It's better to have this much with contentment than to have this much, both hands full, and it's all vanity and grasping after the wind. See, here, the preacher reflects on the value of contentment. That's one thing that money cannot buy, is it? You can have a lot of money but have no contentment. You can be making more and more money. You can have all the success that the world may show you but not have contentment. No, contentment is something else. And that value of contentment, that is to be better than constantly be grasping for more on top of more. I find it interesting, just in those three verses, Solomon weaves together some fascinating themes. He talks about how hard work and success are good, and they're not to be envied, right? The envy of the successful man, that's not a good thing. It's a normal thing, but it's not a good thing. And then he talks about how laziness is wrong and it's destructive. And finally, he says, yet even the one with full hands, you must learn contentment. I would imagine that's probably the greatest lesson that some very successful, very driven people need to learn. They need to learn how to find contentment. And God can give them that gift. Look at it here, verse 7 now. He says, then I returned and saw vanity under the sun. There's one alone, without companion. He has neither son nor brother. There's no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. Solomon thought of a man alone. He has no family, no close friends, and he works really hard, and he's really successful. But then what does he get? He gets more and more, but there's nobody to share it with. There's nobody to pass it on to. Congratulations. You're the richest lonely man in the world. How tragic, isn't it? And so he says right there, he never asked, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? The preacher thought that this unexamined life of hard work and success without family, without friends to share it all in, it's vanity and it's a grave misfortune. You know, if anything, the deep and life-touching philosophy of the book of Ecclesiastes should do anything for any successful man or any successful woman. It should just make you slam the brakes on your life just for a moment and say, what am I doing this for? Is it really just to pile more upon more? Am I doing it detached from relationship? Am I finding meaning in this in eternal context? Maybe. It's all coming back just to the place where you're piling meaninglessness upon meaninglessness. Now you see, the preacher was entirely correct from an under-the-sun perspective. Under that premise, there's no such thing as an eternal accomplishment. And one does not even have the potential satisfaction of passing your accomplishments on to another. But now, starting in verse 9, he's going to think about how without a friend, he thought about the man who has no friends, nobody, family to pass things on to in verses 7 and 8. But look now at verse 9 where he says very tenderly, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Beautiful how he puts it there in verse 9, isn't it? Two are better than one. You see, in the previous section, Solomon thought how even in an under-the-sun world, living alone made life worse. So he continues to develop the same idea, saying that two are better than one, and he'll begin to state the reasons why this is true. Why? Well, first of all, verse 9, because they have a good reward for their labor. In a good partnership, two people can accomplish more than the two ones individually. The sum will be greater than the parts. Secondly, he says in verse 10, if they fall, one will lift up his companion. When two work and live together, they can help each other in difficult times. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. The preacher understood that everybody needs help, and it's a blessing both to give help and to receive help. In verse 11, he gives a third reason. He says, if two lie down together, they'll keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? When two people live together and work together, they bring comfort to the lives of each other. And then finally, in verse 12, the one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. When two people work together and live together, they can bring security and safety to the lives of each other. To use a phrase, they can watch the back of one another. You know, these four verses show us the great value of human relationships, of the fact that two are better than one. Living and working together is a great advantage to living and working alone. And it adds these four things to life. These are the four things. I'll list them again. They add productivity, right? They have a good reward for their labor. Number two, they bring help in times of need. If one falls, then he can lift up his companion. Number three, they bring comfort in life. They'll keep warm. And number four, safety and security, two with can stand an enemy. Do you like how he puts it there at the end of verse 12? He puts a sort of an interesting statement. He says, a threefold cord is not quickly broken. The preacher gives a fascinating final line to this section dealing with the goodness of companionship. We might have thought that he would praise the strength of a twofold cord. But instead, he puts in there the idea of a threefold cord that is not quickly broken. And it's commonly understood that the third cord is God himself, and that a relationship intertwined with God as the third and strongest cord in the braid, that is a threefold cord that is not quickly broken. Now, friends, I would apply this on two levels. On one level, I would apply it to a marriage relationship. I mean, this is often, for most people, the closest partnership that they have in life. And this is the blessing. I can say that it's true in my life. When I read this section here in Ecclesiastes, two are better than one in the following description, there's one person I think of that's true in my life, and that's with my wife. I mean, she's my companion. She's the one who brings strength and comfort and protection and goodness into my life. That's just a wonderful thing that God has given her, and I hope that I give it to her under God. But listen, I don't want to say it's only relevant to the marriage relationship, because I think that would be selling it very short here. You see, I don't think that the point of this in Ecclesiastes is to say, get married. Because isn't there some people that for some reason that just doesn't work, or they have, or they were in the past, but they're not now, or it's just out of their reach for whatever reason. But listen, the point of this isn't get married. The message is have human relationships. Have friendships. And friends, it is. It's a dangerous thing for you to isolate yourself from other people. And for some of us, it's very easy to do. Matter of fact, for some of us, it's very easy to isolate yourself within your marriage relationship, or within other friends that you have. But you see how Solomon is giving us real wisdom here. Even in an under-the-sun world, we need companionship. And if you're blessed enough to be married, well, the primary companion should be your wife. Not your only, but primary companion should be your wife. Not the only friend you have in your life, but certainly primary. Listen, if you're not married, oh, I pray that God gives you such good friends. I pray that God would bring companions into your life that would fulfill this for you, that you would really be able to say, two are better than one. I don't live my life in isolation to other people. This is a tremendous blessing that God has given to man. Now, one other thing I want to say before I leave this. Oftentimes, this is quoted by pastors and such in the marriage relationship and saying how the marriage relationship should have God right in the midst of it, intertwined and being that third cord and the threefold cord. And that's good. But one other thought I just want you to consider. It may very well be in context that Ecclesiastes here has in mind that the third cord in the threefold cord is not God, but it's children. That's what binds together a family. But I think the problem with that is there's nothing here to indicate that the writer to Ecclesiastes had his view only in mind of the marriage relationship. I don't think so. I think it goes beyond that to the friendships and the companionships and the fellowship that God would give us one with another. And going on now, verse 13. It says, better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. For he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walk under the sun, and they were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king. Yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely also this is vanity and grasping for the wind.
For many of us, studying the Bible is a part of our everyday lives. There seems to always be those sections of Scripture that are difficult to understand. What did Jesus really mean when he said, "And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you"? Was Jesus literally telling us to disfigure our bodies? Of course not. We know that's not true. So what does it mean? This is where God has used men like Pastor David Guzik in the writing of commentaries. Pastor David has written numerous commentaries throughout the Bible. In fact, you can find commentary on the entire New Testament and most of the Old Testament at enduringword.com. These commentaries are available digitally at the website and even in mobile format. Concise thoughts about the history, context, and author make these commentaries a valuable resource as you seek to know Jesus more. We encourage you to log on to enduringword.com and select the book and chapter you're currently studying. Or you can purchase a copy of Pastor David's commentary for your Kindle or even a printed copy. Simply log on to enduringword.com and select books from the main menu. Another great option from Pastor David is his book, Standing in Grace. This book details the fact that those who belong to him are not only saved by grace, they stand in grace. Again, for all these wonderful resources and more, log on to enduringword.com. Well, that concludes our time together today. Please place a marker in your Bibles and make plans to join us again for the next edition of Enduring Word Radio.